Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Shortly after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he was contemplating the reality that he had awakened to, there, the insight that had dawned, the understanding that had dawned within him, the first inclination that he had, as probably most people are familiar with, is that he considered the nature of the world, the nature of the reality that he'd awakened to. And his first thought was, there's no point trying to explain this to anybody. As it says in the scriptures, the whole world, the Buddha said, see this broad world. The world is filled with beings that are they relish existence. They know only being, becoming, existence. They are habituated to that, addicted to existence, addicted to being, to becoming. They relish only becoming existence. They relish being. But what they relish brings fear, and what they fear is pain. So he's looking around the world, looking at the nature of all beings, and seeing that there's this massive, comprehensive addiction. All beings addicted to the feeling of existence, to the desire to be, to become. This is the most natural, ordinary sort of root compulsion within all beings is to be, to exist, to become. And as he said in these very poignant and beautiful, insightful words, that they're addicted to being, addicted to existence, addicted to becoming. They relish becoming. But yet what they relish brings fear, and what they fear is pain. Now this holy life is lived, he said, for the complete ending of suffering. So looking out over the world and considering this addiction of all beings to the habits of attachment, becoming, the blind habituation to the feeling of becoming, of being, the feeling was there's no point trying to explain the Dhamma, trying to explain the reality to them. Because, as he points out in that same passage, he said, to abandon the relish for being without relishing non-being. people don't, the beings can't see that, they can't understand that, they can't recognize. What is it to let go of the compulsion to be, the addiction to being, to existing, to becoming, but without relishing non-existence, without attaching to vibhava tanha, annihilation? What is that? Where is that? And this feeling arose within him that no one's ever going to understand this. This is too subtle. This goes against the stream. This goes against the power of habit and compulsion so completely, and no one's ever going to understand this. To abandon the addiction for being without relishing non-being. Where is that? So his heart inclined towards not teaching, to not trying to explain it. It's like if you think of it in terms of the Buddha suddenly realizing that he's the only person who's the only unaddicted person on a planet entirely populated by addicts, then the idea that he's the idea of trying to start a recovery program for a planet entirely populated by addicts, and you're the only one who's not on the stuff. Where do you start? too daunting, too impossible, too challenging a task. So his heart inclined towards inaction, and then as the invitation for the Dhamma talk, this formal invitation, Brahmachaloka Dipati Sahampati, that recounts that exact same incident from the scriptures where the Brahma god Sahampati picks up this thought in the mind of the Buddha and realizes, oh no, the mind of the newly awakened Buddha is inclined towards inaction, towards being passive, to not teaching. So the world will be lost, the world will be utterly lost. So then the Brahma Sahampati beams down from the high Brahma world and then appears in front of the Buddha and says, please, for the sake of those with only a little bit of dust in their eyes, please teach the Dhamma that you understand, because there are beings with the capacity to understand it. There are a few. If you are kind enough, generous enough, compassionate enough to teach, then there will be some who understand. And then, as it said, then the Buddha used his psychic powers to look out over the world and to consider this and recognize, yes, well, Sahampati was right, that there are a few beings with just a little dust in their eyes, and those with coarse faculties and those with sharp faculties, those with little potential, but those with great potential. And so that was on the basis of that appeal from Sahampati, then the Buddha turned his heart towards trying to help and to teach and to convey this mysterious understanding, the middle way of abandoning the addiction to being without relishing non-being. So he set about trying to explain that, and we are the appreciative and much grateful recipients of that inheritance that has come down over the many centuries. So the sutta that we chanted this evening, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, this was the traditionally talked of, spoken of as the second discourse of the Buddha, and it was given to his five former companions. He made his way from Bodh Gaya, the place of enlightenment, to Isipatana, outside of Varanasi, Benares, and met up with these five former companions. And the first teaching that he gave was the teaching on the Four Noble Truths and the Middle Way. And on the giving of that teaching, then it's said, as it's described there in the sutta, Kandanya had the first inkling of understanding, that he was the first one to enter the stream, to realize what the Buddha was pointing to some significant degree. So that's why in that sutta it says, Anyasi Vatabo Kandanyo, Anyasi Vatabo Kandanyoti. The Buddha recognizes, sees that Kandanya has understood. He says, oh, Kandanya understands. Anyasi Vatabo Kandanyo. So the Buddha, in this sort of leap of exultation, Kandanya understands, he's got it, first one. But the others did not awaken to the path. Kandanya became a stream enterer at that point, but the other four didn't awaken to the path at that time. But then it was the second sutta, the second discourse, this explanation of the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. This is where all five of those friends of his then became arahants on hearing this teaching. So this is for these reasons, this is a teaching of crucial importance. And this way of looking at experience is described in this sutta, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. This is, in a way, the Buddha's most thoroughly spelled out description of the methodology of developing insight, of, in a way, seeing that mysterious balance, the mysterious middle between neither attachment to existence nor attachment to non-existence, the Dhamma itself. And the methodology, the manner of approach that he uses in this discourse is, as I was mentioning last night, this is the Vibhajyavada, the way of analysis, the usage of exploration, inquiry, looking at how things are put together. So right here in this discourse, if any of you who have read the English translation of it, you'll see what the Buddha goes through each of the five khandhas, the five groups or the five areas of our experience of body and mind. Rupa, the body, material form. Vedana, feeling, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. Sanya, perception, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Sankhara, mental formations, thoughts, emotions, moods, intentions, memories, ideas, plans, states of refined consciousness. These are all under the sankhara. They're all in the sankhara heap, the group of sankhara. And then vijnana, consciousness, discriminative consciousness, that which is like the basic engine of cognizing, of knowing, of discriminating, discerning this from that, the mechanism of discrimination itself. So that these five groups, or these five areas of experience, go from the most coarse, rupa, physical form, material form, to the most refined, to that of consciousness, cognizing itself, like a spectrum of experience going from the coarse to the refined. And the Buddha just uses this rough chunking of experience just to talk about, you know, these are all the different aspects of body and mind can be grouped in these five, you know, rough categories. So then with each one, he takes this this method of approach of asking these questions to the five ascetics, his five companions. He starts off with rupa, with the body, physical form, and he starts off by asking the most simple, practical, mechanical question. Yeah, is material form in a state of change? Does the body change? Yes, yes, it does. Rupang nichangwa anichangwa. Is it in a state of transformation? Does it change? Does it not change? Yes, it changes. Anichang bante. Yes, venerable sir. Yes, it changes. So, that which changes, is that satisfactory or is that unsatisfactory? Can that lead to affliction, or does it not lead to affliction? So that if something is changing, then in this analysis, the way of looking at it is if it's changing, then it can't be permanently satisfactory. So there can be obviously some pleasant element that comes from it, but that pleasant element, that pleasant feeling, can change, will come to an end. So therefore, it can be disappointing, or it can be something that's just unsatisfying in its natural essence. So he goes through that. Okay, look at the body. Does it change? Yes. If something changes, can it be completely satisfactory? Can it please us permanently? No. Okay. So that which is changing, that which is, you know, unstable, that which is unsatisfactory, is it worthy to say of this, this is me, this is what I am, this is myself, etang mama, this is mine, etang mama, eso hamasmi, this I am, eso me atta, this is myself, my atta, the Atman. And the implication in this, when the Buddha uses this kind of language, is that if something was supposed to be the Atman or the Self, then there would be a quality of stability, there would be a quality of blissfulness, there would be a quality of permanence, of reliability. And so that the answer that they're drawn to by the Buddha leading them in this way is, no he tang bante, no, it can't be, you can't say that of it. Now those three qualities that he's describing there, etang mama, eso hamasmi, eso me ata, these are also called the papancha dhammas, the sources of conceptual proliferation, because these are relating to craving and conceit and views. So the craving, the feeling, the first one is about ownership, about greed, about getting. So this is mine, a feeling of ownership. And this, that's to do with craving or tanha. That's the first of the papancha dhammas. And the second one, conceit, eso hamasmi, this I am, the conceit of I am. This is what I am. And then eso meyata, this is myself. That's to do with views. And in that respect, it's views about the nature of the self, or what the sort of quote-unquote true self really is and its qualities. So he then, as the sutta goes through systematically, each one, taking the aspect of physical form, material form, this body and the material form, the material world outside, tracking it through, following every aspect of it. You say, no, you can't say this is who and what we are. And feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. So leading us through each one, through this way of analyzing, look, you know, that each one of these, each aspect of our body, our mind, as it's experienced, none of these can be said to be truly who and what we are. So what he's doing in this is he's mapping out the methodology of insight meditation. So during the course of this this time together, this retreat period, along with the establishment of concentration and stability of attention in the present moment, then once that a degree of stability, of steadiness is well grounded, is well established, and when the mind can stay reasonably firmly in the present moment, then there's no particular need to hold on to a meditation object like the breath or the footsteps as we do walking meditation. But once the attention is grounded in the present, then we can look directly at the very nature of experience itself. And so this is what the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta is doing. It's helping us to look at the very fabric and pattern of experience itself, how we know this body, how we know this mind, and these aspects of it, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. These are the very tools that are most effectively used to help bring about that same kind of analysis within ourselves, to deconstruct the patterns of experience, so that when we feel a sensation in the body, then in that same way we can ask, is this permanent or impermanent? Is it satisfactory or unsatisfactory? If that which is impermanent, unsatisfactory, is it appropriate, is it realistic to say of it, this is mine, this is what I am, this is myself? So that there's a deconstructing of the experience and going against the stream of habit, the habit of identification, the habit of bhava, of becoming, of being, that says, well, that's my knee and it hurts, or that's the sound of a bird outside, and that's the sound of somebody clearing their throat, and that's outside and it's beautiful, and that's outside and it's ugly, or this is inside and it's pleasant, or inside and it's painful. It's looking at that attribution, the way the mind gives solidity, gives substantiality to the patterns of experience, and seeing how that happens when we look at each experience, each aspect of our knowledge of each moment, watching the flow of mental events. If we bring this acute attention, this analytical attention to that, we can deconstruct all those different experiences and say, recognize, inside, outside, that's just a way of describing things, but it's all known here within this awareness. That sense of good and bad, of pleasant, painful, these are also attitudes, mental formations that are added, that are arising in the mix. These two are all just happening here, they're known here. They too are anicca, dukkha, anatta. Feelings in the body, memories, plans, ideas. Every aspect of our experience, coarse and fine, pure and impure, internal and external. As it, again, it says in the sutta, whether it's in the latter part of the sutta, whether it's inside or outside, coarse or fine, pure or impure, near or far, then of all aspects of rupa, of the body, of the material world, of feeling, perception, then regardless of those aspects, we can see that all of them are not who and what we are. Every single aspect of rupa, we can recognize, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Ne tang mama, ne so hamasmi, ne so me ata. This is not mine. This feeling in the body, there isn't an owner. The sound of a bird, no, it doesn't have an owner. This is not, this memory, this idea, this is not what I am. This is not a self, an individual, a permanent entity. This is not anything substantial, separate, or real. And so it's not just an idea about not self or some sort of philosophical principle, but their heart is being drawn to that direct realization through this way of examining and exploring and recognizing, oh look, how could that sound of a bird have an owner? It's known here, but how could that belong to a person? It's a perception, it arises, it takes shape. How could it have an owner? How ridiculous. And it's that shift in the heart that recognizes, oh well, what's the difference between the sound of a bird and the feeling in my knee, inside, outside? It's all experienced here. It's just the sense of closeness, or the sense of I-ness is more heavily conditioned. But really, this memory, this feeling in the body, what makes it more, what could make it more really and absolutely who and what I am than the sound of a bird or the wind moving through the trees, blowing across the temple roof. How could it? So that change in the heart, that is the true insight, the vipassana. That the word vipassana, we can use it to refer to the methodology of using the tools of examining the experience that we have in terms of anicca, dukkha, anatta. So vipassana is a word describing a methodology. But the real vipassana, capital V vipassana, is the change of heart, that shift, that clarification of the heart, that shift in the heart that goes, oh, look, how could there be a person here? How could this feeling, this thought, this perception have an owner? How could this be a me? Huh. It's that change of heart that is the real insight. That's the real liberating quality. That's the gesture of awakening to Dhamma itself. So the Buddha makes it very, very clear that there's nowhere in the suttas where you can find the Buddha defining a true self or using the kind of language of saying what we really are. And he avoided that because he knew that what happens is that we just take a concept of what we are and then we hang on to it. So he used this other approach, this method of exploration, of investigation, of analysis, to help see where the habits of identification with what we're not, how they take shape and how they're rooted. And by learning to let go of what we're not, then what is real becomes apparent. That's the fundamental method that the Buddha is using in this teaching. And there's a fundamental method of insight practice. There's a learning to see where attachment is forming, where the habits of identification have taken root, and through learning to let go of what we're not, then what is real becomes revealed, becomes apparent. The Dhamma is awakened to, the Dhamma is realized. There's another sutta that I'm very fond of, that where the Buddha talks about the five khandhas in, I find is a helpful reflection in this respect. It's called the Lump of Foam Sutta, and it describes an incident where the Buddha's beside the river at Ayodhya, and he's gathered with a few members of the monastic community, and he sees a lump of foam floating along the surface of the river, being carried along by the current. And he says, "You know, see that lump of foam on the river?" He says, "The material form, rupa, is just like that lump of foam. You know, there's a shape, but there's no substance. If you look at it, if you explore it, there's no core, there's no essence, there's no fundamental substance there. There's just a shape." And then he uses this very lovely series of images. He said, rupa, material form, the body is like a lump of foam. Feeling is like a water bubble, like when the rain falls and splashes onto a pool or a puddle, and then momentarily a bubble forms on the surface. So you have a hemisphere of a thin skin of water forms in a bubble as the water drop hits. Boop, there's a bubble for a moment, but then it's just there for an instant. There's a brief shape, but then it's gone. So rupa, the body, is like a lump of foam. Feelings are like a water bubble. Perceptions, sanya, they are like a mirage. Like in the desert, in the heat of the desert, you think you see an oasis or a town, and then you get there and you realize, oh, it was just a pattern of light. It was just a shimmering form. There was no real substance here. There was a seeming. There was an apparent presence, but there's no substance, no core. He said, with each of these, he said, if you look, if you explore, you'll find there's no essence, there's no substance. It's hollow, void, and empty. Then sankhara, he describes like the trunk of a banana tree, a plantain, that is just a sheaf upon leaf upon leaf upon leaf. And if you pull away the leaves, there's no core, there's no essence, there's no trunk. This is just leaves creating the form of the shape of a trunk. But when you take away the leaves, there's no essence in the middle. There's no trunk. There's no heartwood there. Similarly, layer after layer, layer within layer of sankhara, of mental formations. And we look, we explore, there's no essence, there's no substance there. There's a seeming, there's a form, but no core. And then the last is consciousness, vijnana, is compared to a conjuring trick. Again, there's a magical event seems to be happening, or some kind of miraculous arising, but it's just a trick of the conjurer, and the way that the hands are moved quickly or the attention is distracted so that something seems to be there that isn't really there. So each of these ways of describing the five khandhas, things that seem so real to us, this body, you know, this personality, our memories, our thoughts, our name, our gender, our age, Yeah, our life story, all the stuff that seems to be us, that's so solidly me. You know, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm old, I'm young, I'm English, I'm Thai, I'm Hungarian, Czech. I'm tall, I'm short, I'm healthy, I'm unhealthy, I'm arriving, I'm leaving. I'm comfortable, I'm uncomfortable. All of that, you know, these things that seem to be so intimately and really who we are, just to take that felt perception of what we seem to be and then line it up, hold it up against a lump of foam, a water bubble, a mirage, an empty sheaf of leaves, a conjuring trick. So when we are developing the practice of insight, of vipassana, what we're doing is we're helping to bring about that shift, that change of view, the establishment of right view, really. Shifting the view so that this which seems to be so solid, this conjuring trick of this life, this personality, you know, all that we seem to be, this collection of stories, of memories, of traits and attributes. And just to see, this is a conjuring trick, this is a lump of foam, this is a water bubble, a cloud, it's the shape of a waterfall, it's just like the smoke of the incense, just a swirl of smoke just drifting in the air. That's all it is. But yet it seems so real, so solid. I am a man, I am a woman, I am old, I am young, I am English, I am Sri Lankan, I am Thai, I'm Portuguese. Yeah. That's what this is looking right at, looking at all those, the papancha dhammas, the causes of proliferation, all those feelings of this is mine, this is my body, I am, I am a man, I am a woman, I am a monk, I am a nun, I am a layperson. That feeling of amness, of I-ness, my-ness, is training the attention to go right to that and to see, you know, this is just a set of perceptions. It's hollow, void, empty, insubstantial. And the practice is here, is available for us, the environment is available for us to bring the attention to each one of those little increments of experience, each little chunk of experience where that overall impression is made. To look at what puts the, you know, how the conjuring trick is put together, how the lump of foam is shaped, how the cloud is formed, how the mirage has its particular patterns. It's by looking over and over again, seeing how the trick is put together, then there's this awakening, this quality of liberating insight arises within the heart. And even if it's just for a moment, oh, look, it's a trick. Aha! Once we've seen through the optical illusion, then it's some part of us can't be tricked in the same way so completely ever again. Another of the well-known teachings on this area is, I believe it was a description given by the Arahat Bhikkhuni Vajira, and she uses the image of a chariot. I think this is in the Bhikkhuni Vagga of the Sanyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses. And she uses the description of a chariot, saying the five khandhas, the body and the mind, the personality, these are just like the parts of a chariot all put together. And when you take them apart, you take off the wheels, you take out the axle, you take off the surrounding rim, you dismantle the platform. You take all the pieces apart, and there's no essential chariot there. When you put it all together, you call it chariot, like this body, this personality. You put all the pieces together, the bones and the blood and the muscles and the air and the liquid. You put it together, and you put the memories and ideas and feelings, personality traits. You put them all together, and you call it person. You say it's a person. But if you don't put the pieces together, the pieces are not inherently in a state of togetherness. They come together because of the great cascade of causes and conditions. They come together by the laws of causality and karma, the laws of physics and chemistry, biology, the laws of karma, laws of the mind and of Dhamma. But there's no essential person there, just like when you take the pieces of the chariot apart, then there's no essential chariot. Then you just have bits of wood and metal and leather and, you know. And yet we can still feel, yeah, but actually there really is a person. Well, there is a kind of, there is a chariot. You know, even when you're taking all the pieces apart, you know, still, you know, there's still something in us that remembers, well, there was a chariot there. But it's important to recognize that's just the what the mind adds to it. You know, that that sense of the memory of what was there, or the idea of it as a real thing, that in a sense is the kind of regenerative karma, or sort of what holds things together, is that this kind of habits within our attitude, the habits of memory and naming. And when we take those to be real, then we still will kind of hang on to the memory of the chariot that used to be there, or the or that will sustain the idea of the person, and sustain the particular sets of views and memories and ideas and attitudes. We hold it together. And that's very much our character, that's very much our nature. But it's important to see that that's a constructed thing, that with insight, the development of insight is to recognize there really isn't an essential chariot there, there really isn't an essential person there. It's just a very strong habit of designation. We've got used to that, you know. But this is very natural for us. It's very normal that we do this, and we kind of hold things together with our memories and our ideas. I was told a story of I forget who told me this, but I think it was a friend of ours who lived in Ireland, and was living in this little village, and there was this character there who was a quite a sort of inflated person, and he had very big ideas about himself, and thought he was really going places in the world. And so he had this little bungalow in the village, and he was a kind of inflated type, so that when he got the money together, in front of this bungalow, he built this very grand pair of gateposts, very sort of splendid, glorious gateposts, and got these huge wrought iron gates to stand across the drive. And then the idea was that you know, as his fortunes improved and his business did well, then he'd build a whole big wall around his property, and then the little bungalow would be replaced with a grand house. But after the gates were put in place, then the rest of the funding never seemed to quite arrive, and the business didn't quite improve. And so, but these gates were so ridiculously sort of huge and ornate that this fellow very quickly became known as O'Donnell with the Gates. And so then, as the years went by, and then the gates sat there, and the bungalow was not replaced by this grand house, you know, he got more and more annoyed with being known as O'Donnell with the Gates, and that was a sort of a local joke, or he was being kind of looked down upon or made fun of because of these gates. And so after 15 or 20 years of being known as O'Donnell with the Gates, he finally got fed up with the nickname and thought, okay, well, obviously my fortunes are not improving, and I'm never going to be able to build this big house. So he took the gates down with the idea of trying to shed the nickname that was so annoying to him. But then, of course, he was just known as O'Donnell without the gates. So even though the gates weren't there anymore, he was the memory that the gates had been there still became the defining characteristic. So he's forever more known as O'Donnell without the gates. So even when we are able to see through things, or see that things are actually sort of absent or not, not who and what we really are, there can still be that in the back of the mind that says, yeah, but, you know, even though that thought is impermanent, or that that feeling, yeah, it's not really who and what I am, there actually is a real me here. I mean, it's like O'Donnell without the gates, you know, it's like, there is actually a, despite all the evidence, there really is an actual me here. So these are subtle delusions that stay in the mind very easily. They have a tremendous power. So it takes an extraordinary resolve to keep looking at that, to look at the habit of identification, to explore that, to examine it, to really bring the light of wisdom upon that. So in this light, it's also helpful to understand that, you know, the Buddha talked about two distinct layers of the degree of identification. So the first layer is what's seen through at stream entry, which is sakkaya ditti, or self-view. So this is basically, you can sum that up as the habit of believing, I am the body, I am the personality. I am a man, I'm a woman, I'm an extrovert, I'm an introvert, that all those matter-of-fact characteristics that we look upon as being who and what we are. Sakkaya ditti literally means the view of the real personal, the view of the real body. That I am really this person. I am a body. I'm old, I'm young, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm sick, I'm healthy. I'm a woman, I'm a man. I'm a monastic, I'm a layperson. Yeah, all of that is sakkaya ditti. I'm a success, I'm a failure, I'm happy, I'm unhappy. This is who and what I am. This is all sakkaya ditti. So when stream entry has been realized, then that is seen through. That there's that recognition of, oh, that isn't who and what I am. These are just conditioned formations. All of those particular attributes that can be looked at, the memories, particular characteristics, personality traits, the configuration of the body, you know, it can be clearly seen, this is not who and what I am, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. So at stream entry, that's clearly seen through and is known for what it is. And the other aspects of stream entry are attachment to conventions, silapata paramasa, that belief in rites and rituals in one hand, but also the greater, broader set of attachments to convention, like the social conventions and ideas of right and wrong, appropriate, inappropriate, customs, traditions, ritual forms, social forms, all of that. And then the aspect of doubt, vichikicca, what is doubt about what is and what is not the path. But in this particular respect, though, just confine what I'm saying to sakkaya ditti. So that means it's the seeing through of I am the body, I am the personality, this is who and what I am. So at that point, when stream entry has been realized, there's a radical insight, a clear seeing that this cannot be who and what I am, this body, this personality. So then the second layer of attachment to the belief in self, that the kind of lingering I-ness and me-ness and minus, is called asmimana. And so even though sakkaya ditti is seen through at the first stage of enlightenment, liberation, at stream entry, asmimana is not seen through until arahatship. That's what is called the conceit of I am, or the conceit of identity. Asmi means I am, mana is conceit. Asmimana, the conceit of identity. So that's a far more subtle and refined delusion. And so that this is probably most beautifully and clearly described, or the difference between these two in the Kemaka Sutta, where there's an elderly monk whose health is failing, and he's called Kemaka, and his friends, other monks, ask him, okay, you know, you're getting old, you're getting sick, you know, have you completed your work? Have you finished your task in the holy life? And so they send a message to him, asking him how he's doing, and has he finished his work yet? So, and the beginning of the sutta, there's a whole sort of back and forth set of exchanges and messages between them, and finally Kemaka gets tired of all of the toing and froing and goes to visit them and has a conversation. And there's this very interesting way that he puts things, where he says, I have no doubt whatsoever that the body and the personality and the five khandhas are not self. I can really see that is vividly clear. But yet, this feeling of I am still lingers around, even though it's absolutely vivid and obvious that the five khandhas, the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, these are not who and what I am. But yet, this I feeling hovers around, it's still here, it's still present. And then this very lovely image he uses of just like a flower, with a flower you can smell the fragrance. The fragrance is there, but you can't say whether the fragrance comes from the petals, whether it comes from the stamen, whether it comes from the pistils, whether it comes from the pollen or the stalk, or where it comes from. But yet the scent is there, even though you can't pin it down as to exactly where it comes from. I'm sure botanists would disagree, but yeah, for the sake of the analogy, that's how Kemaka described it. And so he said, so in this exact same way, there is still this feeling of asmi mana, the I am feeling, the I making and mind making feeling, ahankara mamankara, that's there, even though there's no delusion about the body not being a self. Yeah, the personality, thoughts and feelings not being a self. So that's a very helpful description, that there can be that clear understanding, a clear vision that, you know, the body is not self, it's not who and what we are, it doesn't have an owner. But yet, that formless I, me, my feeling can still take shape, can hover around, can be a presence that is deluding and distorting and contributing to that, the feelings of alienation, of separateness, of and dukkha in that respect. It's also very significant in this discourse that not only when Kemaka was explaining this to his friends, that not only did they become arahants, but he became an arahant too. So this is one of the very rare occasions where someone became enlightened listening to their own Dhamma talk. So it is possible that as that was being described, and then there was that a liberating insight, liberating understanding. So in this respect, as we develop this the practice and have this retreat time together, this is an important element to look at, to as we're developing the vipassana, looking into these the feelings and applying the tools of anicca, dukkha, anatta, particularly the element of anatta, bringing that reflection that even though there can be the letting go of, say, when there's the knowing that a feeling in the body or an idea or a memory, the sound of the wind is not who and what we are, to take it an extra layer further and to explore, well, what's the is there still a feeling of I-ness, of me-ness, of my-ness that's around? Is there a feeling of me, the witness, me, the watcher, me, the meditator, me that is doing something, even if that's subtle, formless, is that there? Is that attitude, that I-making and mind-making going on? And if it is, then for that to be known also, oh look, there's, even though as a recognition that sound is not mine, it's not who and what I am, this feeling in the body, that has no owner. But yet, there's this sense of a witness who is here, who's some kind of a me. There's a knower, there's a doer, there's some thing here that is doing the meditation, there's some entity that is doing the knowing, that is the experiencer. That is all ahankara, mamankara, that's I-making and mind-making, that's all the conceit of identity, is exactly that, that formless I-feeling, that formless me-ness that's sort of hovering around the edges and informing, colouring the atmosphere, scenting, bringing its fragrance, its kind of gentle pungency, its aroma to the atmosphere. So it's important to notice that, to be attentive to that, the feeling of me the witness, me the knower, me the doer, me the experiencer. Even if it doesn't take shape as anything connected with your personality, but that very feeling is to be known, is to be seen, to be recognized, and to be let go of. Now, usually the feelings of self, of I and me and mine, it's that's a subtle area of it. But more often than not, where we are witnessing that, those qualities arising, where they take shape, where we get most lost, where the papancha dhammas are most, active, when the craving and conceit and views really take off, and the papancha mill really gets going, that the proliferations really get underway and develop great strength and a powerful deluding presence, is particularly in emotional states, in the sankharas of emotional charge, where things have an emotional impact. So when we're sitting in meditation and everything is quiet, where there's a quality of solitude and stillness, then we're in a way maximizing the supportive conditions for seeing these qualities very directly. And so that in a way is easy to see these, easier to see these subtle movements of self-creating habit, of personality view, sakaya ditti, and then the much more subtle levels of asmimana. But more often than not, is when we're off the cushion, or we're engaging with others, or we're going about our life in the community, and we've got the role of being a person. Suddenly, when we're off the cushion, then we definitely are a monk or a nun. We're definitely a layperson, and we got this particular job, and all those aspects of experience that have got our name written on them, in large letters, firmly etched. Where we are putting on the persona, the role, then it's harder to see. And then also there's much more emotional charge in that when you have been overlooked, and you think, well, I'm senior to him, how come he got chosen and I didn't? That's not fair. Or like, what about me? Or like, I wanted that one, that's not fair, they got that first. Or all of the dozens of different ways that we are caused to experience like emotional flash, where someone treats us disrespectfully, or we get something that we were desiring, so there's excitement, where we're praised, or where we're criticized, where we gain something, where we lose something. When we get what we want, then the flush of excitement and thrill, where we lose something that we like, the feeling of grief and dejection. When someone praises us, the sort of warm, delighted glow of being praised, and when we're criticized or rejected, the sort of bitter, twisted, uncomfortable feeling that comes with being brushed aside or overlooked. You know, all of the worldly winds, the loka dhammas, you know, that's where we most easily get lost. There's much more emotional charge in these. So in that flush of emotion, of sweetness, and when we get what we like, or bitterness when we are separated from what we like, it's important to be bringing the same quality of investigation. And even if it's just in the capacity that we have to name what's going on, like if we get overlooked and someone gets chosen or asked to do something, and we get brushed aside, that when we have that, well, what about me? Or that, you know, that's not fair. No one asked me. Just to take the opportunity to, oh look, there's that offended feeling. This is the me feeling. No one asked me. What about me? Even though the emotion is strong, very tangible, just the degree of mindfulness that can be brought to that says, oh look at that. there's definitely I making and mind making. This is the self creating habit. Look. Here it is, feel it, know it. So it's much more coarse and assertive and impactful than maybe we experience on the cushion or on the walking path, but the same insight, the same understanding can be brought to that. And in a way, it's more that we learn the skills on the cushion so that we can apply that those skills in interaction, where we do have to be a senior person or a junior person, where we have to play the roles of being a leader or being a follower, being responsible for this or giving an opinion about that, contributing in what ways we can. So the usefulness of these practices are, you know, extremely profound. It's extraordinarily helpful. But we have to apply it, so that I would really encourage that as we use the skills that we develop in insight meditation, and we begin to see through in clear and deep ways the way that the personality is put together, the way that the chariot is constructed, the way this entity, this being is formed, that it doesn't just stay on the cushion, it doesn't just stay on the walking path, but that we apply that. We notice that when we gain something, when we lose something, when we're praised, when we're criticized, when we meet with success, when we meet with failure, when we are, encountering all of the ups and downs of the loka dhammas, the worldly dhammas. That's the place to apply it, to at least bring that recognition of, oh look, I really like that. Yeah, that's something that flatters us. How sweet! Something that criticizes us. How bitter that feels. How we really don't like that. To notice that bitter feeling, that sweet feeling, and just that degree of mindfulness, as it says in the Satipatthana Sutta, the degree of mindfulness to know there is this, knowing the angry mind is angry, knowing the mind free of anger is free of anger, knowing the greedy mind is filled with greed, and the mind free from greed is free from greed. Just that degree of mindfulness that knows, oh, here is this emotional state, here is this mood, this is what's here, this is what has arisen. Just that, even that degree of mindfulness is profoundly liberating and profoundly useful to us. And so that as we develop the skills on the cushion, and then we learn how to apply them in the more coarse and demanding field of interpersonal interaction, then we're in a way fulfilling the potential that is there in the teachings, in these practices. We're really taking them, using them to the full extent that they are capable of helping us. and really bringing about that change of heart. So it's not just a meditation experience on a cushion, it's not just a beautiful insight that's apparent when we are in the sort of maximum supportive conditions, but it's with us. It's an abiding attitude, a reflective, investigative attitude that is there with us throughout the activities of our day, whether we're in retreat time or out of retreat time, whether we're in the monastery or out and about in the world outside the monastery. It comes with us. It's here as an abiding presence, and it's like a liberating light that illuminates every aspect of our experience, whether the five khandhas are simple and clear and easily readable degree of intensity, or whether they are very florid and active and loud, and the what we see and hear and feel and think is intense. That same quality of vision, that same quality of reflective wisdom is available to us and can bring about that same quality of freedom, regardless of the pattern of experience inside the monastery, outside the monastery, in retreat, outside retreat. It all becomes the same field. It's all known as the same field of experience. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.